As we continue with our exploration of the Samanipada Sutta, we've come up to the section on, I believe, if my memory serves me well, we've come up to the section on the abandoning the hindrances. Alright? Well, if you can't remember, then obviously your mind's full of hindrances, and we'll have to do it again. So, and my mind, of course. So, that goes without saying. So let's just read through after the section on contentment, then the section on the abandonment of the hindrances. And I'll just read through the text to start with. So it starts out with a little bit of a summary of where we've been so far. Endowed with this noble aggregate of moral discipline, this noble aggregate, this noble restraint of the sense faculties, this noble mindfulness and clear comprehension, and this noble contentment, he resorts to a secluded dwelling, a forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a glen, a hillside cave, a cremation ground, a jungle grove, the open air, a heap of straw. After returning from his round, following his meal, he sits down, crosses his legs, holds his body erect, and sets up mindfulness before him. Of course, I'm reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation rather than Venerable Taittiriya's, which you have in front of you. Having abandoned covetousness for the world, he dwells with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Having abandoned ill will and hatred, he dwells with a benevolent mind, sympathetic for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Having abandoned dullness and drowsiness, he dwells perceiving light. Mindful and clearly comprehending, he purifies his mind from dullness and drowsiness. Having abandoned restlessness and worry, he dwells at ease within himself, with a peaceful mind. He purifies his mind from restlessness and worry. Having abandoned doubt, he dwells as one who has passed beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome dhammas. He purifies his mind from doubt. So this is the abandoning of the five hindrances, and then the Buddha goes on to give a series of similes describing this process. Great king, suppose a man were to take a loan and apply it to his business, and his business were to succeed so that he could pay back his old debts and would have enough money left over to maintain a wife. He would reflect on this, and as a result he would become glad and experience joy. Again, great king, suppose a man were to become sick, afflicted, gravely ill, so that he could not enjoy his food and his strength would decline. After some time he would recover from that illness and would enjoy his food and again regain his bodily strength. He would reflect on this, and as a result he would become glad and experience joy. Again, great king, suppose a man were locked up in a prison. After some time he would be released from prison safe and secure, with no loss of his possessions. He would reflect on this, and as a result he would become glad and experience joy. And again, great king, suppose a man were a slave, without independence, subservient to others, unable to go where he wants. After some time he would be released from slavery and gain his independence. He would no longer be subservient to others, but a free man, able to go where he wants. He would reflect on this, and as a result he would become glad and experience joy. And again, great king, suppose a man with wealth and possessions were travelling along a desert road where food was scarce and dangers were many. After some time he would cross over the desert and arrive safely at a village which is safe and free from danger. He would reflect on this, and as a result he would become glad and experience joy. In the same way, great king, when a bhikkhu sees that these five hindrances are unabandoned within himself, he regards that as a debt, as a sickness, as confinement in prison, as slavery, as a desert road. But when he sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned within himself, he regards that as freedom from debt, as good health, as a release from prison, as freedom from slavery, as a place of safety. When he sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned within himself, gladness arises. When he is gladdened, rapture arises. When his mind is filled with rapture, his body becomes tranquil. Tranquil in body, he experiences happiness. Being happy, his mind becomes concentrated. So this is the process of abandoning the five hindrances. And of course, the abandoning of hindrances is one of the most standard and basic concept in Buddhism that in order for our meditation to succeed, that these five hindrances have to be abandoned, and they're called the dubbalikarane, those things that weaken wisdom or obstruct wisdom. And in this particular sutta, as is typical, the basic passage on abandoning the hindrances is expanded with a series of quite beautiful and very appropriate similes. And the Buddha, again referring to a whole group of quite normal worldly situations, which the king Ajatasattu would have been very familiar with and would have helped him to understand. And it's, of course, very important to use those similes, because if we're not a meditator, and assuming that Ajatasattu was not a meditator before, at least before this, then it's very hard to understand, you know, why these things actually, how these things actually cause suffering. Remembering that the very beginning of the sutta was about Ajatasattu and his mind is filled with remorse and guilt and suffering and so on. And so the sutta is about trying to explain how to overcome that, how to let go of it. And these similes are ways of illustrating, making clear through using ordinary, everyday, worldly situations. And we can then take that and apply that in the context of our meditation. So I'd like to go through in a little bit of detail on some of these passages, having a look at them and discussing what the commentary says to them and so on. In the just to note to start with this first passage. Okay, now if you look at the first passage up the top there, it starts with a little bit of a summary. Okay, endowed with this noble aggregate of virtue, noble restraint of the sense faculties, noble mindfulness and alertness, and noble contentment. Okay, so in other words, we're summarizing the practice that we've already been describing over the earlier passages in the sutta. Okay, now that particular way of describing it, of course, is particular to the Pali version of this sutta, because it summarizes the path as the description as according to the Pali version. And we mentioned earlier that, in particular in the Pali version, that the contentment seems to be a little bit out of place. And in fact, contentment seems to be one of the more simple virtues, which would belong more closely with sila, the development of sila, whereas the development of restraint of the sense faculties and mindfulness and clear comprehension would seem to be more advanced practices, more sort of closer to and getting closer to the development of samadhi. And in some of the versions of this sutta and this particular teaching framework, in fact, we find that contentment is listed earlier up here rather than just for the development of meditation. Now, the Sanskrit text which I have here in front of me, which is the reconstructed Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada version, says something like, and in my not particularly good Sanskrit, so endowed with this noble aggregate of virtue, which is a bit the same, and with this this noble restraint of the sense faculties, so it's the same, and with this noble, this highest mindfulness and alertness, it uses the word parama here, the highest, adhyatan, one experiences inside oneself a blameless bliss. Okay, so that's a passage here, which is not found right there, but this is found up here in the sense restraint passage, that one experiences a blameless bliss. But here it's found in the beginning of the abandoning of the hindrances, so a slight editing difference. And then it goes on to say, experiences of blameless bliss, and then it goes on to say, repeat it, and then to go say he seeks out a secluded dwelling. So in other words, we've inserted the bit about having experiencing the blameless bliss, and the bit about noble contentment is omitted. So these are the kinds of fairly trivial editorial differences which we're used to seeing in the different versions of these standard texts. And then when it says to go to seek out a secluded dwelling, it then says to see if it's the same kinds of dwelling. So that might tell us something. If it has different kinds of dwelling, it might tell us, for example, where the text was redacted. Because if one of them says, I'm dwelling on snowy peaks in the mountain caves, then you think, oh, well, that was probably the Himalayan guys who did that one. And then another one says, well, we're dwelling on a nice beachfront resort. Then you think, well, that was probably the Australian redaction. Okay, so let's just see whether that's the case here, or if alternatively they have the same, in which case it would suggest they were redacted around the same place. So this one only gives us the short version. Oh, that's a bit boring, isn't it? Okay, so this gives us a short version of this. The forest, aranyani, rukshamulani, the root of a tree. The root of a tree. I don't know why it's the shade of a tree there, but the root of a tree. And an empty dwelling. Sunyagarani. Huh, why doesn't he have empty dwelling? Oh no, he's right. Huh, that's curious, isn't it? The Pali version has a forest, a root of a tree. It doesn't have an empty dwelling, which is one of the standard things that you would have in that passage. A sunyagara. Goes straight from there to the Pabata. Interesting, it's probably just an editorial slip-up. So the Sanskrit version just has a brief one, gone to the forest, the root of a tree, or to an empty dwelling, which is three standard ones, and doesn't give the extended list that we find in the Pali. The mountain, the glen, hillside cave, charnel ground, jungle grove, open air, and a heap of straw. And as I've noted several times, that Santi Monastery is one of the few places in the world that actually has all of those things.
Coming from?
Yeah. Well, there's cemeteries in town.
We found.
Close by. Or you could use our when we've got our bones.
We found a dead house.
Did you?
Yeah.
What's a glen? What is a glen? Glen is
little
a valley. Yeah, like a little.
Little wooded valley.
Glen is what they have in Scotland, isn't it?
Yes. A wood dwelling, like the down in the waterfalls. You could call that a glen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shady, deep valley.
Like a gully. Gully or glen. Yeah.
Robin Hood.
It's kind of. Yeah, yeah. We don't quite have a tunnel ground. Okay, it's stretching it a bit, but. Well, we've got bones. We've got plenty of bones and stuff.
I think that's a cave with animal bones.
Yeah. So that's not too bad.
Oh, we got lots of bits of straw.
Yeah, down by the compost.
You can get the straw for meditation hay.
Well, we could get some loosened hay if you like. That's more comfortable.
You could. It would be good in wintertime. You could actually sit inside the heap of straw. It would be nice and warm, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah?
I could do it at the time, like in a hay scene.
Yeah?
Uh-huh.
See, so that's I reckon that's pretty good. Mm. Yeah? You could do that as a practice, couldn't you? Meditate in each one of those places and see which one is the best.
Sabina and I went to a glen yesterday. That was very nice. That's meditation.
Yeah?
Yes, that would have been really good.
No, well, this is what I was saying. Normally, it has sunyagara is the empty hut, but this, for some reason, the Pali is missing that out here. Probably just an editorial slip up.
If you are in the hut, is it still empty?
It's Now that is very Zen. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly, yeah. So you can be in the full hut. Okay, so it's an important point. You know, we can overlook this, but this is something that's very important. The Buddha always said, seclusion, the forest, meditating in nature, that's where you go to meditate. And I always think of that whenever I'm doing a meditation retreat and you go and you're sitting in a room, in the same room with a whole bunch of people and trying to meditate.
Okay.
And you realize that that's not actually what the Buddha said.
Did the Buddha ever say that the beach is a good place to go?
The beach is a good place to go.
Is ever mentioned in Sutta?
No, well, I don't think the Buddha ever went to the beach. Yeah, there's similes where the ocean is used in similes, but there's never mentioned in any suttas that he was in the middle of the Ganges Valley. So, he was a bit deprived, wasn't he? He would have been happier if he'd gone to the beach. So he only wasn't that, not that far, he's sort of around in this area.
There's sort of no beaches downstream.
There would be all marshland and stuff, yeah. You have to get to the south of India to get to proper beaches. Yeah.
So the Buddha never saw the ocean?
Quite possibly, yeah.
They have psychic powers.
Well, maybe, yeah, the psychic powers, yeah.
But he talks about it, the ocean.
Yeah,
it does, yeah.
I don't know about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's mentioned in similes, but there's just no mention of him going, Anga is the furthest downstream that he's mentioned as going. So this is very very important to remember, that choice of a place and having a nice, peaceful place to meditate in is something that was always praised and practiced by the Buddha. And, just to remember that, because sometimes people say things like, you get attached to the forest and blah, 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 and they say you should be able to meditate even if there's noise and stuff around, and if you have to go to a special place to meditate, then, that shows your practice isn't very strong and these kinds of things. So when people say those kinds of things, just don't worry about it. That's what the Buddha said, right? Go to the forest. And if you do it, you realize why. It's just much more peaceful.
But that is it. Often the air is actually quite... open air could mean... does it mean open air with nobody around, or open air with people around, or what? What does it mean open
air? Just being an open place, yeah.
Yeah, so...
like a field or...
a roof.
Yeah, without a roof. Just so you're not in the forest, but just like an open field or place where there's not many trees.
There's not much people around.
Yeah. I mean, all of these places are, it says, he says, go seek out a secluded place. So they're all secluded, yeah? But the open air place is just like an open field where there's not many trees around.
So when did the tradition of sitting in a room for people in retreats come into Buddhism?
Well, hard to say, but the meditation retreat as such was invented, apparently by modern meditation retreat in Theravada was invented by Mahasi Sayadaw, and it seems, and kind of mid 20th century. Yeah, there's very little, evidence of that, or suggestion of that earlier. They did, in Japan, of course, they do the Sesshin, the Zen Sesshin, which is quite possibly was where he got the idea from. But there's no real, I haven't read any real documentation of that whole thing. But then, what you can trace, because it's very hard in history to trace actually what was the meditation practices. What you can trace is the development of the big monasteries, So that in the early period of Buddhism, it's quite interesting. For the first 200 or 300 years, there's actually very little, even though this is one of the historical problems with Buddhism. If you look in the Vinaya, it talks about quite developed monasteries. Yeah, so there obviously were quite large buildings and so on, which was quite substantial. But there's not a single speck of archaeological evidence for any large monasteries up until 300 or 400 years after the time of the Buddha. It's about 100 BC that you first start to appear with substantial monastic remains. And so either they all disappeared, or they were made of wood and bamboo perhaps, or they were all just, simple forest monasteries or something up to that time. And if that was the case, then that might imply, and it has been argued, that the passages in the Vinaya that talk about the very developed monasteries must be quite late. So, but from that period on, you can see there's a standard monastery design, which is actually quite similar to the design they use at Nantian. Yeah, there's basically like rooms around a central squarish kind of room, sometimes rectangular, but often square, around a central courtyard. And there would be rooms for the monks or nuns around the thing, and then teachings and so on would be done in the courtyard. And that's a very standard design, and it's found repeated in many, many different sites all around India. All the buildings at Nalanda are in that form, and it's very popular, I think. Is it still the case in Sri Lanka today, Chandra? Or Venerable? You still have that in the village monasteries, of sort of square buildings around a central courtyard? No? Not so much?
Europe monasteries were built like that.
Yes?
And cloisters.
Okay. Yeah. So whether they actually meditated in a room together or separately in their own rooms is a bit hard to say.
Possibly. You see what happens here. I was just thinking that with Tibetan monasteries, so incredibly cold.
Yeah.
It's easy to have a nice, warm, central place, and they've got their own body. It looks really cute in these Tibetan monasteries, and they've got these benches where they sit, and they've got these sort of like monk-shaped pile of blankets and wool that they sort of leave, and then they get back into them. But on the same sort of things, people who really, people gravitate towards the hall in winter.
Yeah, that would have a big deal, a big lot to do, huh?
Some of you go to these places and do it here in Spire, especially go to Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Also often, as I talked about, some of the sorts of deer and deer, a lot of the time it's not in the
I don't think that's...
Especially stays alone.
Yeah.
Many people may be.
Yeah, somebody who's lived in the forest, a villager who's in their village all the time and never goes into the forest, is afraid of the forest. But once you've actually lived in the forest, you don't become a fear.
Okay, so then goes on after the meal. Returning from the armchair, and sits down, crosses his legs, holds his body erect, and brings mindfulness to the fore. Come back to that statement later, but just to notice here that it's continuing. I've mentioned before that practice of mindfulness and clear comprehension, while not being totally explicit, but is mainly talking about the practice of going into town for the alms and collecting alms, coming back, eating the meal and so on, going to the toilet, and so you can see this is kind of basic monastic lifestyle. And then when that's finished, then the text is as if proceeding with that. It's actually a description of a daily practice after the meal, then sitting down to do meditation. Of course, many monks have commented that this seems to point to a complete difference in bodily functions in those days compared to today, because usually if you go and sit down and meditate straight after the meal, most people just fall asleep. And so anyway, most commonly, most monks do walking meditation after the meal. and then have a rest if they need, and then do sitting meditation, and rather than straight to that. But I might just, before going on, I might just read here from the commentary. And so this is the commentary to the Samanyapada Sutta, and give some idea of how this was explained by the teachers of old in the Mahavihara. Okay, so by the first passage, by mentioning the endowed with the noble aggregate of virtue and so on, the Buddha shows the achievement of for the requisites for living in the forest. For one who lacks these four requisites, i.e. who lacks the aggregate of virtue, restraint of the sense faculties and so on, does not succeed in his forest life. He would fall under the same category as animals or forest wanderers. The deities residing in the forest would think, what is the use of living in the forest for such an evil bhikkhu? They would make frightful sounds, strike him on the head with their hands, and make him run away. A bad reputation would spread about him. Such and such a bhikkhu, having entered the forest, did this and that evil deed. Okay? But one who has achieved these four things succeeds in his forest life. Reviewing his moral discipline, he doesn't see any stain or blemish, and he arouses rapture. Exploring that rapture by way of its destruction and falling away, he enters upon the plane of the noble ones. The devas residing in the forest are happy and speak praise of him. His fame spreads widely like a drop of oil put onto water. Okay, so then goes on to explain some of the words used. There. The commentary to the Samanyapada Sutta.
Where does that come from?
What do you mean, where does it come from?
Is it something recent or something that was written 100 years after?
We've discussed this from the beginning. We've been reading this before. This is Buddhaghosa's commentary.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so... okay, so then he goes on to give some comments on the individual words, and I won't go through all of them. Typically, the word commentaries in the word analysis in the commentaries is sometimes useful, and often is just only useful for linguistic purposes. But I'll just have a look through, see if there's any interesting points in here. Secluded, it says, if it's not crowded with householders and monks, then it is secluded. Dwelling is defined, and according, it quotes here from the Vibhanga, and it says a dwelling, a bed, a chair, a cushion, a pillow, a dwelling place, a building with a sloping roof, a rectangular building with a gabled roof, a flat-roofed building, a natural cave, a multi-storied mansion, a circular house, a rock cave, a bamboo thicket, the foot of a tree or a pavilion. These are also dwellings. Any place where the bhikkhu returns are dwellings. And so on. So it goes on to basically anywhere you're staying.
So the mansion can be referred to as those big monasteries that are built for the
mansion. Yeah, exactly, I mean, the classical example of that is the palace of Midara Mata, Visakha's palace in Savatthi, which is a large seven-story building. Okay. The definition of forest that's interesting. In the case of bhikkhunis, a forest is explained as everything beyond the pillar marking the boundary of a village. Interesting. So that's an explanation given for the bhikkhuni, the rule about bhikkhunis living in the forest. But for the bhikkhu described here, it is fitting for his forest dwelling to be at least 500 bow lengths from the village. The characteristics are explained in the Visuddhimagga, blah, blah, blah. So 500 bow lengths from the village. I guess a bow length is, what, a meter or something? So half a kilometer from the village, ideal, at least, which is not all that far. the foot of a tree, blah, blah, blah. Huh. The mountain, it says, is a rock mountain. For when one has bathed and drunk in a rock tank and sits down in the cool shade of a tree, fanned by a cool breeze, with the various quarters all visible all around, the mind becomes one-pointed. A glen, so here's the definition of a glen, is a mountainous region divided by water. Some say it is a place where rivers rush and roar, for there the sand is like silver foil. The jungle thicket overhead is like a jewel-studded canopy, and the water flows like a mass of jewels. Having entered such a glen, drunk and cool one's limbs, heaped up sand and prepared a seat from rag robes, when one sits down and does the work of a recluse, the mind becomes one-pointed.
So if one has cooled one's limbs in the glen, presumably you bathed in the cooling waters of the stream.
Sorry?
But you bathed in the water, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that wasn't allowed.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I thought you were allowed. You're allowed to bathe.
Yeah. Once every 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, well, there's that kind of vineyard issue, but no, you definitely can bathe in glens. And it describes a heap of straw. Having collected straw from a large heap of straw, they build an abode similar to a hillside cave. So it's not just sitting on top of straw, but it's actually like a straw hut. They also throw straw over bushes and brush, etc., and sit underneath it where they meditate. Oh, look, I didn't want to go into it in detail, but it just mentions it in passing.
Yeah.
But it says that in the case of bhikkhunis, a forest is explained as everything beyond the pillar marking the boundary of a village.
Beyond the marking?
Yeah.
Within the boundary?
No, outside. It's not half a kilometer away. It's right adjacent.
Half a kilometer away is like...
That's the vehicles, so that's when it's suffering. It's not half a kilometer. It's right there.
It's near.
Near the village.
Remember, this is just... Because I didn't want to dwell on it, because this is just a commentary throwaway line. Okay, so there's a detailed discussion of that in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya studies, so I don't want to recap the whole detailed discussion of that.
I'm just like reflecting about the Chinese language says that the Bhikkhuni must not stay alone.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was okay if the commentary says that there is a definition of it, so obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yep.
The next line, after his meal returning from his arm,
yep.
Does it mean the bhikkhu would have his meal in the village and then return to the meditation place and that would be his exercise?
Yeah, it seems to suggest that, doesn't it? Yeah?
Does the Pali spoke that?
Let me see. Pachabhatam, after the meal, pindabhat patikanto, coming back from Ramchan. Yeah, it's not explicit.
It doesn't really.
But you could either understand both of those as referring to the same thing, or you could say eating in the village. I mean, obviously that's described elsewhere. Sometimes they did eat in the village; otherwise, they'd come back to the monastery. Let's see if the Sanskrit has anything there. No, Sanskrit doesn't have anything. Okay. So then it goes on to describe the posture. The commentary goes on to describe the posture in some more detail. And this is something which is not discussed in detail in the early Pali texts. And it's quite an interesting thing, because obviously in Western culture these days the practice of yoga is very popular, and it's kind of a lot of the science of yoga is very developed, but it's not easy to discern whether or to what degree that was developed in the time of the Buddha. Of course, you have the ancient Indus Valley seals, which show yoga postures from thousands of years before the Buddha. But on the other hand, the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which is a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, doesn't really give any more information on posture than you find here. Basically, cross your legs and hold your body erect. So that's basically all it says on physical exercise in the Yoga Sutra. So our evidence for yoga as a science is much later. But here it says, sits down, crosses his legs, holds the body erect, and brings mindfulness in front of him. Now, there's a few debated points here. Crosses the legs is in Pali, nisirati palankang, palankang abhujitva. Okay, so palanka being the word here. The commentary to that says he binds them with the thighs completely locked. Okay, so that seems to be a description of full lotus posture, where your legs are crossed and the thighs are fully locked with the heels resting on top of the thighs. It's not entirely sure what that actually means. The word palanka is sometimes palanka. Sitting cross leg, huh? Palanka doesn't give a Sanskrit Padyanka, something in the Indian, cross-legged palankena. Cross-legged. You see, it has too many. See, it has this many here of sitting cross-legged, pari and anka, whatever anka means, what anka means. But then the second meaning of it is also, is a divan, a sofa, or a couch. Okay, so you've got two quite distinct meanings. One is the posture that you're sitting in, and the other is the actual seat. Some people suggest that actually there's only the one meaning, which is the second meaning. I've heard some Sri Lankan monks explain it that way, that when this says it doesn't actually mean sitting down cross-legged, it just means sitting down on the meditation seat. Yeah. So you can either, you've got your choice here. You can read it either way, and I'll leave that up to you. You can either sit in cross-legged in full lotus posture, or you can sit on a sofa, okay? And if anybody says to you, you can't sit in meditation on a sofa, you just refer them right to here, to the Pali Text Society Dictionary, and says, that's what it says. It says, sit on a couch. And do meditation. Interesting though, isn't it? There's something that's so basic, and yet, not quite sure.
Is the couch of the sofa or the bed considered as a luxury couch or something?
The couch? Well, unless you're using it to meditate on, I mean, it can't be too bad.
It's a bit like the word seat. It can refer to your posture or it can refer to the thing you're sitting
on. Yep.
Yeah. Palanquin, English word.
Palanquin, yeah, probably from the same root, I would guess. Yeah. Anka, Vedic anka, hook, bent. So this is where they get the idea of bending. Now it's related to it's related to the word angle. So paryanka, hook, the lap, the bent position of the hips. Huh. So it does have the meaning of bent, which would seem to support the idea of, you know, bending your legs. So anyway, that's one little thing. Sits down, cross your legs, hold body erect, and the way that's described here, he sets the upper part of his body erect, aligning the 18 vertebrae end to end. Yeah. Is that the right number of vertebrae?
No, there's a lot more. Perhaps he's referring to the
For when one sits in this way, the skin, flesh and sinews do not bend forward, and the painful feelings which might arise moment after moment because of their being bent forward do not arise. As those feelings do not arise, The mind becomes one-pointed and the meditation subject does not fall away, but arrives at growth, success, and maturity. So, interesting to notice that the reasoning here in the commentary, so the first thing it says, you should sit with your back straight, and it says, why? It says, because if you don't, it'll hurt. And when it hurts, you won't be able to get your meditation to work properly. Yeah? It's, of course, very different from the meditation advice you hear from so many meditation teachers today, that pain is useful, pain is your teacher, and so on and so forth. But very clearly, that what the commentaries are saying is that you should try to sit in a way so that you're not going to feel too much pain. Because if you do so, you're not going to be able to get samadhi, which is, after all, the point of the exercise.
Also, if you don't have cushion, or raise your neck, actually, the lotus position forces your back to be
right,
spread.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Yeah.
I think that's why they think
that's the
position, because it makes it easier to see.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think likely it was. Lotus position is definitely the best. Yeah. Definitely the best position for meditation if you can do it.
Holding the body is right. I mean, in the Chinese temple, we always put it. We do sit on the chair. We're not supposed to lean against the back because it's not going to be very helpful for meditation.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with that.
So, is that ever been taught in the Thai or Sri Lankan?
No, because they always just sit on the floor. But it's not correct to say that. I've been meditating on a chair for about 17 years now.
No, they say that you shouldn't be leaning.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's not correct to say that. Yeah, and this is something that I learned because that's what I was told, and so for ages I tried to sit like that, and then you realise it actually just doesn't work. Basically, the problem is that if you try to sit like this, your body is just not balanced. In order to keep your lower back straight, in just the same as when you're sitting on the floor, it's actually only when the thighs are angled down that you can get your lower back straight. Yeah. And the problem is, but it's fine, you can sit with your thighs angled down, and then very shortly, then you'll be doing like that. And if you try to sit on a chair for hour after hour, like that, inevitably you're just going to slide off it. You just can't do it. So you're either fighting against your natural posture, and that's why chairs have backs. That's what I realised, that's why people would backs on chairs, because otherwise, you know, like that. Yeah. So actually it's not correct to do it like that. Yeah. This particular chair is just about perfect for meditation. If you're going to meditate on a chair, okay. Here's the Jado version of meditation chair. All right. Number one, chair is made out of wood. It's good. Yeah. Okay. Metal is not too bad. But metal tends to be a bit cold, but wood is good. Plastic is very bad because it's wobbly. Yeah? Point number one. Point number two, it doesn't fold or swivel or sit on runners. Yeah? It's got four legs, yes, which sit nice and firmly on the ground. Yeah? So that's good. Yeah? And it's got a nice, generously sized seat with enough padding on it. Yeah? One of the things with sitting on a chair compared to sitting cross-legged is that the weight is much more focused, yeah, on your buttocks. Like if you're sitting on cross-legged, you actually share your weight out over the thighs and then the legs and so on. So it's a bit more spread out. But it gets quite painful if you don't have enough ground to sit on. And you shouldn't have arms. Arms are bad because when you're sitting there, they sit on there. And if you're sitting with your hands in one position on arms for an hour at a time, extremely painful, yeah? So it should not have any arms, and the back should have a longish back like that, like not a bar for the back, because then again that gets quite painful. Little gentle little curve on the back, like that, a little bit of an angle, and
it's to be the right length. Your legs.
The right height, exactly, right. Yeah.
So I always I've got one of those in my foot, and yeah. I always have it pushing under my feet.
Exactly, yeah, so that depends on how long your legs are. This one's pretty much right for me. Often I find that they're too low, so I sit with just a little bit across or straight like that. And what else?
Why is it that so many mothers teach us to put our tongues like that together with the tongue touching each other?
Oh, that's good.
Is it the part of the yoga posture, or is it the part of law energy, or whatever?
I don't know.
Why it is? Well, I think that comes from Qigong. Qigong.
Yeah. You find it in India as well, yeah. Buddha images.
Some put it on the.
Yeah. People do do these a few different ones, but that's very common. I mean, that posture is very nice because the reason I think that posture is good is because when your thumbs touch very lightly like that, you can just feel them, and it's just like a point of mindfulness that your hands are exactly right.
The other day, an individual was saying that she learned from somebody who explained that when your mindfulness is not there, your thumbs get separated and your fingers get separated. And it's true,
that's
what I realized.
Yeah.
When you really have mindfulness, your posture is there intact. But when your mind starts to scatter, then your thumbs just separate and your fingers get separated. So maybe that's also.
Yes.
Yeah. But we are kind of like that, hey, you are not getting.
So, change for those things. How to pick a good meditation chair. Okay, so, okay, and then the next passage, Pari Mukhan Satim Upatapetwa. Venerable Misro translates and brings mindfulness to the fore. Bhikkhu Bodhi says he sets up mindfulness before him. Pari Mukhan Satim Upatapetwa. The Sanskrit says Prati Mukhan Smriting Upashtapya. So the difference here is that the Pali has Pari Mukhan and the Sanskrit has Prati Mukhan. It's a different prefix there. Pari Mukhan Sating Upatapetwa. A very controversial little phrase et here. So the commentary here explains it as he applies mindfulness towards his meditation subject or he sets it up in the region of the mouth. Hence, this is said in the Vibhanga. This mindfulness is set up well, at the tip of the nose or at the sign of the mouth. Okay? And the sub-commentary to this then goes on to say that the sign of the mouth, the mukha nimitta, is the middle region of the upper lip against which the air strikes when it comes out of the nose. Yeah, so this is a classical explanation for this, and one of the problems with the explanation is it obviously assumes that you're doing anapanasati, right? And it makes sense in the context of anapanasati, but actually the sutta itself is not talking about anapanasati, and the sutta is clearly meant to be a general text which should apply whatever kind of meditation that you're doing, okay? And so this is why the explanation is somewhat curious. Now, just to come back here to the basic problem, sati, we all know sati is mindfulness, upattapetwa. Now, upattapeti is the verb. Now, sati upattapeti is a very, very standard idiom in Pali. Now, one of the things that you notice when you're looking at Pali and looking at the Pali text is that there's a very common idiom where a noun and a verb are used together that have the same meaning. Okay, so you find, for example, one rouses up energy. Okay, where the word to rouse up basically just means to have energy, or you say one sadhang adhimuchati, one decides on faith. Okay, so where the decision and the faith are essentially the same meaning. So these kinds of idioms are very standard in Pali. And this pair is used in exactly the same way, sating upatapeti. So it seems to me that upatthana as a noun, it basically has the same meaning as sati. So the idea you could say here, one focuses mindfulness, something like that. They often translate it literally as one establishes mindfulness. But however that may be, however you choose to render it, these words are the same words that you find in the compound satipatthana. Okay, so the word we're very used to, the satipatthana, the four satipatthanas and so on, is simply a compound of these two words. That itself is a little bit controversial because the explanation given in the commentaries says that it can be sati plus patthana or sati plus upatthana. And the meaning patthana, so these are two alternative explanations for the etymology of satipatthana which are offered in the traditional commentaries. Okay? And patthana means a cause or a foundation. And it's because of relying on that particular interpretation of satipatthana that we have the modern translation, the foundations of mindfulness. Okay, that's where it's based on. And the idea there is that the foundations are the objects of meditation. Okay, so here, this is if you interpret it this way, then the four satipatthanas are like the four objects on which mindfulness is founded or grounded. The word upatthana, meaning establishment or focusing, and is much more similar to the word sati itself. There are contexts where they're used synonymously. So here it's referring more to the subjective act of setting up or focusing your mindfulness rather than the objective thing on which your mindfulness is focused, which is what is suggested by this etymology. So linguistically, I don't think there's any particular doubt that sati and upatthana is in fact the legitimate derivation. And the reason for that is because, firstly, this idiom is so common, absolutely standard, found dozens and dozens of times in the suttas. You never find sati and patthana used together. You always find, and you rarely even actually find the word patthana used in that sense in the early texts. It's actually a later term. So sati upatthapetva, and the other reason, of course, is that the Sanskrit is a smritupasthana. So the Sanskrit clearly derived from sati and upatthana rather than sati and patthana. So that's how it's understood in all the northern schools or Sanskrit schools. So that's just to clarify the term a little bit. But then the other problem that we have here is with parimukha. And I discussed all this in History of Mindfulness in some detail, but the word mukha literally means mouth, okay, but can also mean face, it can mean entrance, it can mean cause, it can mean whole stacks of things, okay, and let's just see what the dictionary tells us about mukha. So many, as many meanings as the word, you know, face or mouth or something in English. Which is why there's so many occurrences of it. Mukha. Okay, so here's all the entrances for mukha. Yeah, so you can see it has so many different meanings, and it's related to the English these various words. A very very prolific root. So face, the mouth, the entrance, a cause, a way, or means. The front, the part, or the top, the top of anything, the head, and so on. The best part of anything is also a mukha, yeah, and so on. So all these different meanings, and of course, well, you're more or less welcome to invent your own interpretation. The text itself doesn't explain what parimukha means as such, so you know you can go for it if you like. But the word pari means around, okay? The prefix pari means around. And parimukha is used, apart from this context, in only one context in the early texts. And let's see if it has the reference here. That one context is in the Vinaya. So there's another context which itself is then confused in the explanation. So the other context is in the Vinaya, where it's talking about hair. Okay, so it's talking about growing and arranging the hair. It's not to cut off, it's karapeti, it's clearly to arrange the hair, to do a hair, literally a hair do, okay, because it's karoti, to do, right? So he's got to cut off for some reason, it's a mistake, but this is to make a hair do, but the parimukhan, so you're doing a hair do, parimukhan. So here, as it seems to me, obviously the parimukhan means around the mouth. In other words, this is the monks who are shaving their beards or making some kind of fancy goatee or moustache or something like that, right? So maybe they were doing like the Salvador Dali twirled kind of moustache or something. Now then, unfortunately, it's then explained in the commentaries as saying ure, which is on the chest. Yeah? And so it's like you're making fancy, you know, you're doing fancy decorative hair chest arrangements, yeah? Which is kind of a bit bizarre, even for the group of six monks. Sure. And why parimukha should mean the chest is kind of bizarre. It seems to me quite a strange explanation, but obviously men do, you know, the beard is quite a thing that, you know, guys get attached to and like to, you know, do their beard and moustache and stuff, so surely that's what it means. So if that's the case, then in the Vinaya, then parimukha means literally around the mouth. Okay? So that would tend to support that explanation of parimukha as having like a particular physical location, meaning around your mouth, like for doing breath meditation or something like that. However, we have another problem, which is that the Sanskrit, and I was wondering, the Sanskrit dictionary is a bit problematic. The Sanskrit version of it. Parimukha, near or present. Yeah. Okay, so the Sanskrit doesn't actually have parimukha. The Sanskrit has pratimukha. Yeah? Which is a different prefix. Because pari means around, prati means against. Okay? And so we have meanings here. One meaning of pratimukha is the reflected image of the face. Mm-hmm. Possible. In drama, a secondary plot or incident which hastens or retards the catastrophe. Okay, well, I think we can assume that's probably not what's meant here. Pratimukha. An answer? Probably not. Standing before the face or facing. Okay, so this is like pratimukha, like literally against your, you know, You're in your face. This is what it means, you know. The English idiom, in your face. So that's what it means. But it also has this meaning here of paratimukha, being near or present. Yeah? Towards, in front, or before. Possibly. So it seems to me, of course one can, again, choose any of these meanings if you like, but it seems to me that the idea of being present or near is quite a good meaning here. Yeah, so it's like you're establishing a presence of mindfulness. Yeah, you're bringing your mindfulness. You know, it's present. Yeah, and so again, it's not entirely clear: is the Sanskrit form of this or the Pali form? You know, the original one. Well, it's really a bit hard to say. It could be either, but certainly I think that gives quite a nice meaning for it. Yeah, so establishing a presence of mindfulness. So. Yeah, the upshot of all that kind of rather long discussion is that we don't 100% know what that phrase means, and that it can be either interpreted in a literal physical way, as meaning literally paying attention around the mouth, or it can, I think perhaps a bit more plausibly, be explained as just simply presence. One establishes a presence or focuses a presence of mindfulness.
Yeah? You ever get in Bali three words, yeah, which are synonymous?
Yeah, you do. I mean, you get endless lists of synonyms. Yeah. So
the pratimukha, being present, also is synonymous with sati and asapeti.
Exactly, yeah. And that's that's kind of what I think is probably happening. It's we probably, in that case, pratimukhang, in that case, the phrase, in that case, this parimukhang sating, parimukhang is it's not like saying you establish mindfulness at the parimukha, but you establish mindfulness which is parimukha. Yeah? So this is like an adjective for the word. And that's a very, again, that would be a very standard. See, here you have exactly the same construction here. You set up an ujjunkaya. You set up a straight body. Yeah? You're having established the present mindfulness. Yeah? So, certainly works grammatically.
With this, the sati and upatthana and sati and patthana, you're saying that sati patthana definitely doesn't mean four foundations of life.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So it just means basically the sort of two synonyms of the same thing. Or
exactly, yeah. And that's why in, you know, you see in the old translation Foundations of Mindfulness, which Bhikkhu Bodhi used in the Majjhima middle length discourses, and then this is one of the things that we had some discussion with at the time, and then I argued that it should be upatthana and establishing, and then he actually changed his rendering in the connected discourses to establishments of mindfulness. Yeah.
Could we use the same principle for abhijitva nisirati palankam? Would that work?
Sorry, abhijitva nisirati palankam. Oh, okay. Yeah. Except nisirati is a verb. Nisirati palankam abhijitva. Yeah, it's slightly different. It's a different construction because this is a present tense verb. These are all the gerunds. Having set. Yeah. Not entirely sure about that. Grammatically, it's a bit unclear to me. Okay. So, in any way, keep it simple. He's mindful. Right. Good. We got that bit. We've got clear enough. Okay. So then. Goes on to talk about the abandoning of the hindrances. Now, I probably won't get through, we'll see how we go, all of these things. So, the list of five hindrances is, of course, completely standard, one of the most basic doctrinal categories in Buddhism. Curiously enough, though, the first of the five hindrances is known by two different words. Most commonly in the list of the five hindrances is kama chanda, yeah, desire for sense experience or sensual desire. But here it uses the word abhijang. Okay, it's pretty much, I understand that it's a synonym, but it's interesting that there's two different words used. So the explanation here doesn't add a whole lot to that. One abandons abhijja for the world and then dwells with the heart removed from covetousness, and one cleans the mind from covetousness. Okay, vyapada, the second one, ill will, padosang, is a synonym, both meaning anger or will. Pahaya, having abandoned. Abhyapana chitto, with mind free from ill will, one dwells. And then, this adds a nice, interesting little phrase here. Sabbapana bhuta hitanukampi. Yeah? One dwells compassionate for the benefit, or for the welfare, the hita, of all pāna, breathing things, and bhūta, beings. Okay, someone dwells full of compassion for all living beings. And this word anukampa is a nice one. And it's the word kamp. The root kamp means to shake or tremble. Yeah. So the idea is you're literally trembling with compassion for all living beings. So it's very much the idea of, it's very similar to the idea of resonance in music, yeah, where you have like one string, on a guitar or something like that, and if you pluck that one string, then all the strings that are in tune with that will resonate next to it. Yeah? So this idea of resonating. Yeah, and that's the word they use. That's the technical musical term, yeah, is to resonate in sympathy.
So,
the noun is anukampa. You know, it's used in the standard phrase of the Tathagata who teaches the Dhamma anukampa upadaya, out of compassion for the whole world.
Karuna.
Yeah, same as karuna. And then again, one cleans one's mind from anger and ill will. Tina midhang, tina is translated as sloth and torpor, or drowsiness or whatever. Pahaya, we get a tina midho viharati, aloka sanyi, yeah, percipient of light. So it's kind of interesting phrase there. And again, one of these phrases, it's not entirely, I mean, obviously the general idea is straightforward enough. When the mind's light, then it's not dark and drowsy. But it's not entirely clear to me whether this means that one literally looks at a light, yeah, or whether it just means that your mind inside is bright. I mean, I would guess it probably means your mind is bright inside, but actually looking at a physical light can also be a good way to help overcome drowsiness. If you're meditating and can't keep awake, then just open your eyes and have a look at a light and you're good. Aloka sanyi.
Is it like a nipa?
Well, probably not directly. No, it's probably just more just generally the mind, just like in English you'd say the mind is bright. You know? Not specifically an imita. Sato sampadano. Mindful and clearly comprehending. So it's interesting that these two qualities are mentioned specifically in this context of abandoning the hindrance of sloth and torpor, not specifically in the other one. So obviously that plays a strong role there.
So it's, yeah, alertness.
Alertness.
The opposite of sloth and torpor.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably a good rendering there.
It seems to be describing the first jhana here. Is it describing the first jhana?
No.
No?
No, this is just describing abandoning the five hindrances.
Not through the jhana?
Jhana's come up next.
Oh.
Hmm?
You said the specific, I don't know, pattern of when sati means carry, when the sati just like normal awareness?
Is there a pattern?
Yeah, does it like, say in the, I don't know, meditation setting, then vision means more that way, or
it's
usually just in both?
Yeah, it's a bit hard to draw hard and fast rules there.
Modern meditation sort of treatment idea of mindfulness and solvable problems. Because the Buddha always taught these different techniques overcome the hindrances.
Yeah.
They don't have time to do their work. They
like
to see the pure or sense creatures walk through the sutra and overcome such desires.
That's
going to be much more realistic and more practical as well.
Yeah.
You know, might be your life is taking like such a desire or something and it doesn't appear.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, that's explicitly stated, certainly with ill will, in Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha, there's this Yaka who comes to the Buddha and says that if one's always mindful, then one overcomes hatred. And the Buddha says, no, you don't. He says, you overcome hatred by loving kindness. Yaka Samyutta, maybe? I don't find the reference. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. Mani Bhadra Sutta. So then the Buddha was saying among the Magadhans in the Mani Malike Chaitya in the Manimalika Stupa, or Chaitya, this would be like a woodland shrine, not a Chaitya as we have it, but a woodland shrine for the Yaka of Manibhadra. And then Manibhadra, the Yaka, came to the Blessed One, and Manibhadra would seem to mean attached to jewels. And then he comes to the Buddha, and, you know, being a yaka in a woodland shrine, what do you expect him to say? He starts out by saying that Bhadra, he is not attached. It's another meaning of Bhadra is joyous. Satimato, one whose mindfulness is always joyous or always sees what is auspicious, and one who's mindful, sukha medati. I'm not quite sure of that one, but one who's mindful is always happy. Mindfulness indeed is always better, and one is freed from ill will. Vera cha parimuchati. So one is freed from ill will. Vera being another synonym for ill will. And the Buddha responds, so that's the Yaka's verse. And always in these Sagatavaka verses, the Buddha always kind of takes the good parts of the verse that's spoken and then trumps it. He makes it even better. And he says, repeats the verses, Satimato Sada Bhaddan. So then one is mindful, is always good, is always excellent. Satima, one is always happy. Satimato Suveseyo is always better. Vera na parimuchati. So the only word he's changed is cha, is now changed to na. Vera na parimuchati. Yeah? So one is not freed from anger. Yeah? So by practicing mindfulness, one is not free from anger. Yasa, for one who all day and night delights in non-harming, their mind delights in non-harm, ahimsa, who has metta for all beings, that person has no anger. So it's quite a nice little... But I have to admit, he might have got the last line wrong, but I reckon that's pretty good for a yaka anyway. So, but a very important point, you can't overcome all the hindrances just by means of one thing. Yeah? Each hindrance has its own characteristics and needs to be dealt with in its own way. Mindfulness, of course, is always useful, so it's not saying, you know, you don't be mindful, but it's just saying that mindfulness alone is not going to solve all those problems. So, come back to that text. Uddhaccha kukkuccang pahaya. He abandons restlessness and remorse. So udhaccha, I'm not quite sure what the root of udhaccha is, but restlessness or agitation. Kukkuccha is an interesting one, because kukkuccha is, the root of kukkuccha is, who knows what the root of kukkuccha is?
A bird.
Sorry?
It's a bird.
A bird? A cuckoo?
A crow.
A kaka is a crow, yeah. No, there is kukuta. Kukuta is the English word, no, is a chicken. The English word cock for a chicken is a kukuta, but this is a different word. Yeah, kukuchang. Kukuchang is from the root kar. As you were just about to guess, I'm sure, but just to do. Yeah? And it's, and it has the abstractive ending. No, it's very complicated to derive it all, but it has the abstractive ending of ya. But it's from the kat, this past participle, plus ya, is an abstract ending, and it has the prefix ku, which means bad. Okay, so that's actually the derivation of it. Ku is bad, kat is done, and ya is just an abstractive ending. Bad done-ness. Yeah? Bad done-ness. Yeah? That's the literal meaning of kukucha.
Harmfulness.
Sorry?
Harmfulness.
No.
No.
No, because it's past tense. It's not someone who's doing harm, but it's the past tense aspect of it, which is important. So that's why he translated it as remorse.
Mm.
So it's the feeling that comes from having, I've done something bad in the past. And so there's an interesting sutta where a monk comes to the Buddha. It's closely associated with keeping sila. Okay, so if you keep your sila, keep your precepts, then it helps you to get rid of kukkucha. But there's an interesting couple of suttas where a monk comes to the Buddha and the Buddha says, or the Buddha goes to see a monk, I think, who's sick. And he says, how are you feeling? And so on. He says, I'm not well and I have a lot of kukkucha. And the Buddha says, well, do you have any problems with your sila? And he says, no, I don't have any problem with my sila, but I just regret the fact that I haven't accomplished as much in my meditation as I would have liked to have done. Yeah? So it's a sort of a feeling of remorse. It doesn't have to be necessarily doing something wrong or bad in the past, but, you know, even omission. You know, I haven't practiced as hard as I can, or I regret something. So it's that mind which goes back with a sort of sense of negativity and worry to what's happening in the past. Whereas Uddacha, of course, is always the restlessness, is always running off to the future. Yeah? So this pair, restlessness and remorse, are always sort of dragging us into the past and the future. Okay, fine. Sorry?
Like what they're wrong and what could I be saying, also the spring of the futures that are out in circles.
Yeah.
Why not use the word dukkata?
Dukkata? Yeah, I guess it's just an idiom. It's just an Indian kukucha. Kukucha. Okay, I have to have a look at that. Now, kukuku could be even. Maybe it's actually. Ku is occasionally. It's not a very common. Ah, well, that's interesting, isn't it? No, kukucha. Well, it's the Sanskrit one. Oops. Could and kicha, yeah. So could. Yeah, it would be a similar meaning to the word dukkata, but just an idiomatic difference. Ku, I mean, I think ku is much more rare, and what we normally understood that it's more intense. Then do is very widely used. But yeah, it's just an idiom, I guess. I can, perhaps it's just used because of the sounds better. Kukucha. So, kukucha. Right. So one cleans one's mind from uddhata. Interesting phrase added here. Ajhatang rupa santa citto. Internally, one's mind is very, very peaceful. Yeah? So vi upa santa. Rupa santa. Yeah? So one's mind is very peaceful. And then the last of the five hindrances, vitikicchang, pahaya, having abandoned doubt, one dwells having crossed over doubt, akatankati, one is not questioning regarding what is good, what is wholesome dhammas, okay? Vitikicchaya chittang parisodheti. So this is interesting that's qualified in that way. One's not doubting regarding wholesome dhammas. In other words, you're not sitting there in meditation, confused about what you're doing and unclear and so on. And the word here for doubt is literally is from a katankati, but the word katang is like, means like what? Yeah? So katang is katang is what? So you're, doesn't have good time. Anyway, just trust me on that one. So you're sitting there going, what, what? That's what katankati means.
So that's
akatankati.
That means doubt.
It means doubt, yeah, it means
but
what, what?
With an A, one has no doubt.
No doubt, exactly, one has no doubt.
What does vichikicca
mean? Vichikicca. Now, vichikicca is another interesting little etymological thingy here. It's actually from the root to cure, as in to cure a sickness. and it's actually quite a which is double C on Wichicha, and it's a desiderative reduplication for all the Pali nerds here. You've been looking for one of these, I know. Wichicicchati, doubt, perplexity, one of the Nivaranas, Dhammesu, and so on. Oh, it doesn't give the etymology here. Kichati. They both mean doubt, yeah, it's another example of the use of synonyms. But yeah, the kicca, the root, the actual root is, I can't remember what the root is. I think the root is altered as well. It doesn't give the root here. Wichicicchati. Let's see if it has that. Wichicicchati.
So it seems like doubt isn't just a straightforward characteristic. It's not quite knowing what to do. I mean, it's not saying, well, I don't believe the Buddha or something like that, but it's, you know, it's not doubting in that very straightforward sense. It's doubting or being perplexed. And
yeah, perplexity is a good. Yeah, it's related to those things. I mean, it can be those bigger kinds of doubt as well. But here, we're talking about approaching jhana here. So, you know, you've already right at the beginning, you know, that the person has gained faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. You know, that's the beginning of the practice. So there's already a degree of faith here. But then it's not giving us the. So it's jikichati, but this is a reduplicated root. From the root to cure. This is, I think, incorrect. And I'm not sure of the exact. Anyway, I'm not sure of the original form of the root. I think it's altered. I think it's doubled and then altered. So, anyway. So, it basically means I don't know how to fix this. Yeah? So, it's a root to cure. Vi, meaning to divide. Yeah? So, doubting. Vi, one's divided. And, What? That's what doubt is. Yeah. What? Doubting. I don't know how to fix it. I'm worried about how to solve this problem. I'm worried about how to cure it. So I'm saying. Langle. Langle songsai. Yeah. Songsai is from Pali. Long le means
Dawala.
To hesitate. Okay, Long le. Long le Songsai. Songsai is from Pali Sangsaya, which is another synonym. So one's abandoned, another one's abandoned. So that's all good. And then it gives the. So this is basic synonyms on these five hindrances. Now, the commentary here refers to the Visuddhimagga. So it says, it gives a short explanation for the hindrances, and then it says, whatever has been said concerning these five hindrances, the analysis of their word derivations, characteristics, and so on, all has been said in the Visuddhimagga. So this is a standard method that the commentaries use, is that they refer back to the Visuddhimagga for the explanation of the central doctrines, and then they explain the things which are found peculiar to each sutta, but then the very common things like the hindrances and so on are explained here. So I won't go into that right now, as we'll be getting on a little bit, but if you want to look more at what the commentaries say about all of these hindrances, then there's a lot of information in the Visuddhimagga, and the Visuddhimagga actually goes into quite a lot more detail into not just the five hindrances, but other kinds of things that are obstructions to meditation. And so they're actually quite useful, and some of those are quite good. And I'll just have a look at those just very briefly. You have the 10... What is it? 10. Blah, 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 blah. 10 impediments that you should sever before going on to meditation. Okay, so the 10 impediments, very briefly, I won't go through the whole thing. First one is a dwelling is an impediment, but only for somebody who keeps on thinking about it and who's attached to their dwelling. Okay, so it gives a story about two monks who went forth in the Tuparama at Anuradhapura. One of them learnt the two codes of the Parimokkha, went out to stay in a place called Pachinakandaraji. The other one stayed where he was. And the one who'd gone to Pachinakandaraji had lived there a long time and had become an elder. He thought, this place is good for retreat. Suppose I told my friend about it. So he set out, and in due course he went back to the Tuparama, met his old friend. And the visiting elder went into his lodging. He thought, now my friend will be sending me ghee or molasses or a drink, for he's lived along here, a long time here in this city. But he got nothing that night. And in the morning he thought, now he's going to send me some rice gruel and solid food sent me by his supporters. But he didn't get anything. And he thought, there's no one to bring it. No doubt they'll give it when we go into town. In the morning they went to town together. When they wandered through one street and had got only a ladle full of gruel, they sat down in the sitting hall to drink it. Then the visitor thought, perhaps there's no individual giving of gruel, but as soon as the time for the meal time comes, people would give me lots of special food. But when the meal comes, all they had was what they got when they received alms round. Then the visitor said to his friend, Venerable Sir, how is this? Do you live like this all the time? He said, Yes, friend. Then he said, Well, Venerable Sir, where I'm living is comfortable. Let us go there. And as the elder had come from that city, by the southern gate, he took the Kumbhakaragama road, which leads to Pachinakandaraji. The visitor asked, But why, Venerable Sir, do you take this road? And his friend said, Did you not, sir, recommend Pachinakandaraji? And then he said to his friend, But how, Venerable Sir, have you no extra belongings in the place you've lived in for so long? That's so, friend. The bed and chair belong to the Sangha, and they're put away as usual. I don't have anything else. But, Venerable Sir, he said, I've left my staff and my oil tube and my sandal bag there. Have you already collected so much, friend, living there for just one day? He said, Yes, Venerable Sir. Okay. So then the visiting monk paid homage to his friend and said, For those like you, Venerable Sir, everywhere is a forest dwelling. The Tuparama is a place where the relics of the four Buddhas are deposited. There's suitable hearing of the Dhamma in the Brazen Palace, which was the huge monastery with several thousand monks living in it. There was the great shrine to be seen, and one can visit elders like the time of the Buddha. It is here that you should live. And then he took his bowl and robes and went away. Okay? So the moral of that story is that even if you're living in a big city monastery with lots of wealth and so on around you, if you don't have any attachment, then that dwelling is still suitable. So this is the thing. But you have to understand that if your dwelling is unsuitable and you're attached to it and so on, then you need to sever that attachment before your meditation can be successful. The next one it talks about is family. Okay? So obviously, again, a family who consisting of supporters. A family consists of either relatives or of supporters. Okay, so family being kula. So either your actual relatives or just the people who are supporting you. So if you live in close association and very attached to them with the family, then that's an obstacle for you. But on the other hand, if you're not attached in that way, then even living close with your mother and father is not an impediment, as in the case of a young bhikkhu who was the nephew of an elder who lived at the Korakanda monastery. And it goes on to tell another quite a long story, which I won't repeat. So these are all very lovely little stories that the Visuddhimagga is full of. Next one, that the impediment that one has to sever is gains. That's the four requisites. So if you're attached to the requisites and you can't stop thinking about them and so on, then it becomes an impediment. Then it says here, Even at dawn, alms food eaters who are fond of opulence come and say, Venerable Sir, such and such a male lay follower, woman lay follower, friend or friend's daughter wants to see you, and he gets ready to go, he takes the bowl and robes, and he's always on the alert. Yeah? Thus, requisites are an impediment. So if you're always hanging out to get good stuff. The next one is a class like we have here, right? So if with the this going to classes and listening to groups, instructions and questioning, he gets no opportunity for to do the ascetic's duties, then that group is an impediment for him. Just remark here that it mentions about questioning. I mean, something that I hear again and again is that in the traditional classes in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and other places, that you can't actually question anything. Yeah, and here it mentions that in the classes you're questioning, and actually that's what you find absolutely all the way through the texts. I mean, the Abhidhamma texts are absolutely nothing more than a series of questions and answers. And you constantly find references to that in the commentaries as well, that, you know, somebody will be in a class and then asks a question and there'll be discussion. So it clearly was a very important part of the Buddhist tradition was, and of course, you know, not even to mention the fact that it's constantly through the suttas that people are asking questions of the Buddha. And yet, these days seems to be, you know, the thing to do is to sit in a class and just be told and you can't ask questions. Anyway. No. Don't be impertinent. Go on.
How does class class has been an impediment to meditation? Is that like going to classes too much and not spending time meditating or what?
Yeah, exactly. So but also it's also talking about teaching classes. Okay. If the students have already learnt most of the stuff and there's not much left, he should finish that off and then go to the forest. If they've only learnt a little bit and there's still a lot left, then he should think without travelling more than a league, approach another teacher and say, "Could you come and help out with that teaching?" And then even if he can't find anybody in this way, he should still take leave of the class saying, "I've got a task to see to, friends. Go where it suits you," and he should go and do his own work. Yeah. So you know, and again, like all of these things, it's not putting down teaching or being in classes. It's just saying that time when you really want to develop your meditation, if the class is a distraction, and remembering that, you know, in many of these monasteries, there's, you know, they're just classes all day. It's just a college. Next one is building, which is kamma. Yeah, new building work. Since once engaged in this much know about what material has and has not been got by carpenters and so on, and must see about what has and has not been done, it is always an impediment. It should be severed in this way. If little remains, it should be completed. If much remains, it should be handed over to the Sangha or to bhikkhus who are instructed with the Sangha's affairs, if it's a new veiling for the Sangha, or handed over to somebody else and then depart. Right? So nothing much has changed there. Travel is going on a journey. If someone's expected to give the going forth somewhere else, or if a requisite is obtainable there and he can't rest content without getting it, or even if he goes into the forest to do the ascetic's duties, he'll find it hard to get rid of thoughts about the journey. Yes? And of course, very true as well. Yeah, every time you travel, you think about, am I going to go here? What's going to happen? How will I get there? And so on. One in this position should apply himself to the ascetic's duties after he's done the journey and transacted the business. Kin is another word. In the case of the monastery, means the teacher, preceptor, co-resident, pupil, those with the same preceptor and so on. In the house, it means mother, father, brother and so on. When they are sick, they are an impediment for him. Therefore, that impediment should be severed by curing them with nursing. Okay? So it doesn't say go off and leave them to die. I'm going to go and do my meditation while you rot. Bye-bye. You look after them and cure them and make sure they're well first. And then you go off and meditate. Okay? Yeah, and when the preceptor is sick...
That means, Bhante, that when you're sick and everybody's trying to cure you,
mm-hmm.
you should allow them to, because they'll be so worried about you they can't meditate.
Mm. I'll bear that in mind, yeah. Okay, when the preceptor or teacher is sick, he should be cared for as long as life lasts, if the sickness does not soon depart. And likewise with the other teachers and the pupils that one's gone forth with and so on, and that those have the same preceptor. So one should either look after them as long as life lasts, or in relevant cases, for as long as one's living in dependence on them. And if one is able to do so, one should even look after them even beyond that. Okay, so it's saying even if you've been in dependence on a teacher, or been living together with another student, okay, so another young monastic, those who we grow up together with, then you should always look after them if you're in, as long as you're in that relationship. But even afterwards, if you've left dependence and go and live somewhere else, and then you hear that that monk or nun or whatever is sick and needs help, then you should try to do what you can.
With it referred to teachers, pupils, and what about the other family members?
It goes on to talk about that. Yeah, mother and father should be treated like the preceptor. If they live within the kingdom and they look to their son for help, it should be given. If there's no medicine, he should give of his own. If he has none, he should go in alms, search for it for alms and give that. But in the case of brothers and sisters, one should only give them what is theirs. If they have none, then one should give them one's own temporarily and later get it back. It's stingy. But one should not complain even if one does not get it back. So in other words, it's greater duty for mother and father than for brother and sister. And so on. So
this assumes that monks don't have offspring.
No, they can feed themselves.
Yeah. Okay, and that next impediment is affliction, any kind of illness, and should be cured. But even if it's not cured, then you should still go off and meditate anyway. Books. Now, another impediment means responsibility for the scriptures. That's an impediment only for one who's constantly busy with recitations, etc., but not for others. Okay? And here's a few questions. The elder Revata, it seems, was the reciter of the Majjhima Nikaya, went to the elder Revata, who was the dwelling in Malaya, the hill country, and asked him after a meditation object. So we've got two Revatas here. The elder asked him, "How are you in the scriptures, friend?" He said, "I'm studying the Majjhima Nikaya." He said, "The Majjhima Nikaya is a hard responsibility, friend. When a man is still learning the first 50 by heart, he's faced with the middle 50. And when he's still learning the middle 50, he's faced with the last 50. How can you take up a meditation subject?" So, it's interesting that this is still mentioned in terms of learning the Nikayas by heart. Of course, when Buddhaghosa was writing, was about 500 years after they'd first written the texts down. So it's either the case that the oral tradition of memorizing the text persisted for many hundreds of years after that, but also it's the case that much of the material that Buddhaghosa used actually stems from a much earlier time. So a lot of the stuff in the Visuddhimagga and the commentaries, in fact the vast bulk of it, probably stems from several hundred years before Buddhaghosa's life, so perhaps referring back to a time when it was the normal situation was that you'd memorize them. Of course, it was a very gradual process of moving from oral memorization to using written text, and that process is, of course, not complete today. We still recite texts. And then he said, "Venerable Sir, when I have taken a meditation subject from you, I shall not look at the scriptures again." He took the meditation subject and did no recitation for 19 years and reached arahantship in the 20th year. But, you see, there's always this twist in these commentary stories. He told the bhikkhus who came for the recitation, "I haven't looked at the suttas for 20 years, friends, but I'm, you know, reasonably familiar with them." And so from beginning to end, he recited them with not hesitating even over a single syllable. Okay. Elder Mahanaga, who lived in Karuliagiri, also put aside the scriptures for 18 years, and then he recited the Dhatukatha to the bhikkhus. When they checked this with the town-dwelling elders of Anuradhapura, not a single question was found to be out of order. So the next story is a bit long, I won't go into that. So, for such as these, the books are no impediment. Okay? So books only impediment if they're getting in the way of your practice. And the last one, supernormal powers. Yeah? Psychic powers. They are hard to maintain, like a prone infant or like a baby rabbit. And the slightest thing breaks them.
Yeah.
hard to look after your psychic powers as hard as looking after a baby rabbit. They are an impediment for insight, not for concentration, since they are obtainable through concentration. So the supernormal powers are an impediment that should be severed by one who seeks insight. Yeah? And all the other impediments you talked about are severed by one who seeks concentration. This is the detailed explanation of the impediments. So that's quite interesting. And I'll just read a lot of other very interesting stuff about this one of the probably the most interesting and useful parts of the Visuddhimagga is this part talking about these different aspects of how to develop meditation and examples from life and how different practices work. But I'll just go on to read the another very useful one is the 18 faults of a monastery. Okay. And we're having some discussion about this with the ABS group, the Buddhist Studies, the university scholars, and they were laughing because they were saying actually the 18 faults apply just as much to a university as they do to a monastery. Okay, first one. Living in a large monastery, lots of people with lots of different aims gather. They conflict with each other and neglect the duties. Okay, so when you have a big monastery, lots of different people, some are there to study, some are there to just hang out, some are there to meditate. Yeah. The Bodhi tree terrace and all of those things are unswept, the water for drinking and washing is not set out. He thinks I shall go, which is kind of interesting. This is what's called the tragedy of the commons. And it's an idea in sociology, which is that resources which are held in common tend to be less well maintained than resources which are held in private. Yeah? Whether that's true in general or not is debatable, but this is the idea here, that because in big monastery everybody thinks somebody else will do it. Yeah? You've got 500 monks here, why should I go and sweep the Bodhi tree, you know? So when you go out you see that these things haven't been done, and so then you either worry that haven't been done or you have to do it unexpectedly. You get the, if you don't do it then you get a dukkata for not doing your duties, but if you do it you lose time. You arrive late when you're going for alms around to the village because you've been doing all the work for the other monks, and you don't get anything because they've gone in first and they've got all the food. And then when you go and retreat you're distracted by the loud noises of novices and young bhikkhus. And by the Sanghakama being carried out, the chanting Sanghakama. However, it is possible to live in a large monastery if the duties are being done properly and there's none of the other disturbances. Okay, so that's one. Second one, a new monastery. There's lots of building going on. If you decide you don't want to do the building, you get criticized. Okay? But it's okay if you live there and the other monks say, it's all right, you go off and meditate and we'll do the building work. That's all right. A dilapidated monastery is no good because there's lots that needs repairing. And if you're there and all these things need fixing and you don't fix it, then people will criticize you. And if you see that do all the fixing up everything, then you can't meditate. A monastery with a nearby road by a main street. Visitors keep arising day and night. You have to give up your own lodging if others become late, especially if senior monks arriving late or something, and you have to go and live outside by a tree or on the top of a rock, and the next day it's the same, you can't meditate. Okay, a pond is a rock pool. People all come there for drinking water. Pupils of city-dwelling elders, supported by the royal family, come to do dyeing work. When they ask for vessels, wood, tubs, etc., they must be shown where these things are. So he's kept all the time on the alert. Now, that's a very curiously specific little complaint there, isn't it? Yeah. The pupils of city-dwelling elders, supported by the royal family, come to dye their robes. Yeah. It's probably a real-life situation. Now, he goes with his... next one. When there's lots of leaves, where there's many sorts of edible leaves in the monastery, women from the village come and gather the vegetables, singing as they pick the leaves nearby, all right, thus endangering his meditation subject by disturbing it with sounds of the opposite sex. All right. Which is very true, and you see that in monasteries where, you know, quite where there's food and stuff, and somewhere like Wat Manachat, there's lots of different food growing around the monastery, and the villagers come and picking the monastery, and they're singing and all kinds of things. Same thing when there's flowering shrubs. When there's many sorts of fruits, such as mangoes, rose apples, and jackfruits, people who want fruits come and ask for them. They get angry if you don't give them any, or they take them by force. And when they come in, and when he's walking around the monastery, he says, you know, lay followers, what are you doing here? Then they abuse him as they please, and even try to evict him. And again, all of that happens. And he lives in a monastery that is famous and renowned in the world, like Dakyanagiri, Hatikuchi, Jetiagiri, or Chittalapabata. There are always people coming who want to pay homage to him, supposing that he is an arahant, which inconveniences him. Yeah? But if it suits him, he can live there at night and go somewhere else in the daytime. Yeah? And if one is living near to the city, then persons of the opposite sex come into focus. Women water pot carriers go by bumping into him with jars and giving no room to pass. And it's a big problem, those water pot carriers. Also, important people spread out carpets in the middle of the monastery and sit down. I don't know. One with nearby timber trees, where there are timber trees useful for making framework, is inconvenient because of the wood gatherers there. People come down to build homes and so on, and same as with the fruits.
This is the version of the play trucks.
People make use of a monastery with nearby fields, surrounded by fields. They make a threshing floor in the middle of the monastery itself. They thresh the corn there, dry it in the forecourts, and cause great inconvenience. And when there's extensive property belonging to the Sangha, the monastery attendants impound cattle belonging to families and deny the water supply to their crops. Then people bring ear of paddy and show it to the community, saying, look at your monastery attendant's work. For one reason or another, he has to go to the portals of the king or the king's ministers. This matter of property belonging to the community is included in property near arable fields. So there's a conflict and conflict of interest when you've got big grounds between the monastery and the people living by. And obviously the monastery attendants, it seems, in some cases would be acting very independently and seemingly sort of, you know, catching all people's cows wander into your monastery, and you say, well, they're ours now, so you keep hold of them, and so then there's law problems and so on. And again, that's a very realistic thing, you know, where many places, Phujom Kom and other places, you say there's cows wandering over, and it is legal problems, because for example, it's national park. It's actually illegal to bring your cattle into the national park. And but of course, you know, there are villagers who were there with their cows long before it was made into a national park, right? So, but then they're leading their cows, and the cows come around. Unfortunately, Phujom Kom, the big problem was that the kutis were built on sticks. And of course, the big problem is termites, right? So you build the kutis on poles. And the builder, Chang Derm, in his wisdom, decided to keep the termites out by putting salt all around the pillars. Yeah? Because, of course, the cows love the salt, don't they, right? So you've kept the termites out. But all the cows immediately zero in on the mark of kutis, yeah? So they're always having hassle. And they've all got their bells with their dun 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 dun. You've got herds of cows. Yes, yes, so they're coming and rubbing against your kuti. And, so it's a bit of a hassle. And you get hunters and things. Okay, arable fields, presence of incompatible persons, where there are bhikkhus living there who are incompatible and mutually hostile. When they clash, and then they say, we didn't do that. and then they say, this is another interesting one, we no longer count now that this refuse rag wearer has come. Yeah? In other words, when the Dutanga monk comes or the forest monk comes into the monastery, the monks who were there previously, who may be not so strict in their discipline, start to whinge and complain because they're saying, oh, everyone's, you know, just paying attention to this ascetic monk, yeah? Because he's wearing the rag robes and we're nothing now. So the jealousy and conflict cause. So one with a nearby port of entry. People coming and going all the time. In the case of one near the border countries. Okay, so this is in the outlying districts. People have no faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha there. Yeah? Like, oh, I don't know, Australia, for example. Huh? So, of course, that makes it more difficult. You know, you're more restricted. You can't, you know, get arms in places so easily and so on. In one near the frontier of a kingdom, there is fear of kings. For perhaps one king attacks that place thinking it does not submit to my rule, and another one does likewise. And then the bhikkhus lives there, and it's conquered by first one king and then conquered by another. And then they suspect him of spying. Yeah, which again is very, very true, and that's in the Arata Shastra. You find that even in the suttas, the mention of ascetics used as spies by kings, and in the Arata Shastra, it specifically recommends the use of monks and ascetics and prostitutes, the two favoured livelihoods for spies. Unsuitability is that due to the risk of encountering, seeing people of the opposite sex or haunting by non-human beings. And of course, it's worst of all is when it's both. Here's a story. The elder lived in the forest, it seems. Then an ogress stood at the door of his leaf hut and sang, Yakini. The elder came out and stood at the door. She went to the end of the walking path and sang. The elder went to the end of the walking path. She stood in a chasm 100 fathoms deep and sang. The elder recoiled. Then she suddenly grabbed him and said, Venerable sir, it is not just one or two of the likes of you that I have eaten. All right. A chasm 100 fathoms deep. So this is the siren song that she's singing there. Lack of good friends. When it's not possible to find a good friend as a teacher, or the equivalent of a teacher or preceptor, then the lack of good friends there is a serious fault. Okay, and the contrary thing, so that's the 18 factors, faults of a monastery, and then the 5 good factors of a monastery, which just giving them, it gives in detail here, the 5 good factors, and this is from the suttas, so that list of 18 is a purely commentarial list, but from the suttas, 5 good qualities of a monastery. Number 1, a monastery is not too far nor too near and has a place for coming and going. All right. So a place too near is one, say, in the city or something like that. One too far, maybe somewhere like, what Buddha Dhamma or something like that. And somewhere not too far and not too near is just like Santi Monastery. It is little frequented by day with little sound and few voices by night. There is not too much contact with gadflies, flies, wind, burning sun, and creeping things. Okay, so the weather and environment is suitable. One who lives in that lodging easily obtains robes, arms, food, lodging, and the requisite of medicine as cure for the sick. So you've got sufficient supplies of requisites. And in that lodging there are elder bhikkhus living who are learned, versed in the scriptures, observers of Dhamma and Vinaya and the Matikas, and when from time to time one asks them questions, how is this, Venerable Sir? What's the meaning of this? Then those Venerable Ones that reveal the unrevealed, explain the unexplained, remove doubt about the many things that raise doubt. These are the 5 factors of a monastery. So here we go. That's the 5 good qualities of a monastery. And one very, very last thing before we finish up this evening is the lesser impediments. So once you've sorted out all of those things, then there's just a few other things that you may have minor impediments. That is to say, long hair, long nails, or long body hair should be cut. Mending and patching of old robes should be done, or those that are soiled should be dyed. If there is a stain on the bowl, remembering there were clay bowls, the bowl should be baked. The bed and chair, etc., should be cleaned up, and this is severing the lesser impediments. So this is what we're doing in this period before the rains retreat, yeah? And just making sure all of those things are sorted out in the monastery, all those practical details. If you need to get your robes together or anything needs cleaning or fixing up in your kuti or something like that, then this is the time to do it. Okay, that's that. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good, isn't it? Sati, in terms of meditation. So, that's that. So it's a little bit long for the lesson today, so I apologize for that. And from next week we'll go on and have a look at the four jhanas. So let's finish by paying respect.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādine svākhāto bhagavata dhammo dhamma namassami sappipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham.